Thank you for joining us for this chapel message from the campus of Columbia International University in Columbia, South Carolina. Our mission at CIU is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ.
This morning, we're extremely honored to have Andrew Brunson, American pastor of the Resurrection Church, which is a Presbyterian congregation in the city of Izmir. Andrew is a Ben Lippin graduate. He then went on to earn a BA degree from Wheaton College, a master's from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, an MDiv from Erskine Theological Seminary, and a PhD from the University of Aberdeen. Little did I know, when I went to Washington, D.C. 2 years ago with Franklin Graham, and about eight others, and we went to the West Wing of the White House to have a meeting on religious persecution. And as we were there in that meeting, we met with Kellyanne Conway, we met with the Vice President, we met with Governor Nikki Haley, we met with different members, Marco Rubio, Senator from Florida, we met with Senator Ted Cruz, all came into the room, and while the 10 of us were in that room that were representing the Christian evangelical community, they asked us about our greatest concerns. And we expressed concerns that there was a man named Andrew Brunson who was in Turkey, who was in prison. Absolutely, I had never met him, but that was the main gist of our conversation, that this administration had to do something to free him. I'll never forget that day. One, I was in the West Wing for the first time, and that was pretty exciting. But to have the opportunity to talk about religious persecution around the world, which is quite grave today in many places, and then to get to talk about one of our Ben Lippin grads, and I made it clear that this was one of our own. We are also glad to have Noreen with us. We know that you have been through much, but I would like to convey to you this morning that the Ben Lippin family and the CIU family took it seriously to pray for you day after day. And now we rejoice this morning in bringing you to this platform. Dr. Brunson, we want you to come and share your story of how God has used your life. Welcome to CIU.
Thank you very much. My mother went to Columbia Bible College. That's what it was called back then. They had a lot of rules back then. I don't know if you do now, but back then she tells me about the rules. She said that, there was a no-touch policy. I don't know if you still have that. But she said when it rained, everyone would go out with their umbrellas, because that was the one time the girls could hold the arm of the guys. They could walk under the umbrella in the rain under the, anyway. So CBC, CIU, what a legacy. How many people have gone out to the mission field? I grew up on the mission field. My parents were missionaries in Mexico. We're singing Great Is Thy Faithfulness. You know, it took me a year in prison before I could sing that. Before that, I would choke up. I couldn't get it out. People would write to me and say, Andrew, you need to sing like Paul and Silas. How they sang in prison. And I thought, they were only there for one night. And we don't know how they were singing, do we? We don't know if they were full of joy and happiness, or if they were singing it as a sacrifice of worship and praise in the midst of pain and as a discipline before the Lord. I did learn to sing in prison, but it took me about a year. I'm very glad to be able to share with you, and a number of you prayed for me. I'm very grateful for this. And I want to tell you one of the results of this, because in 2009, to put it in context, in 2009 the Lord spoke to me. It doesn't happen very often, but it was very clear. He said, prepare for harvest. We'd been in Turkey for a number of years at that time. And I was surprised at that, because I thought normally in missions, as you look at missions history, there are many decades of sowing with very few little result. And then that's when the move of God comes, after all that sowing. I thought there hasn't been much sowing in the Muslim world. Turkey is the largest unevangelized country in the world. Most cities in Turkey do not have any church. Most Turks have never met a believer in their lives. I thought, how can we expect a harvest? And then he said it again to me, prepare for harvest. And it surprised me, but it began to grow in my heart. And I began to see what God is going to do is accelerate this process so that we will end up reaping and seeing a great harvest where there has not been that much sowing ahead of time. It will just be a powerful move of God. So after that, we began to, and everything we did, we were asking God's guidance, Lord, what do we do to prepare for a great move in this country? How do we lay a foundation in preparation for this? And so in 2016, when Noreen and I were called into the police station, we thought we were going to get our long-term visas, residence permits, and instead they told us, we're arresting you to deport you, to expel you from the country. I thought, wait, how can this be happening? We knew it could happen, that was a possibility, but I thought, wait, we're preparing for harvest. What's happened? Have I done something wrong? Have I displeased you, God? Are you cutting off my assignment to prepare for harvest? And I was very confused about this. And then in prison, as the imprisonment dragged on, and I began to hear about the prayer movement that was growing around the world, I've been told it was an unprecedented prayer movement focused on one person. And what happened is that God used me as a magnet to draw prayer into that place. It was a supernatural move of God. It was a supernatural prayer movement. It wasn't just Noreen reaching out to different networks and having people pray. God was doing this. He started it and he drove it forward, because there were so many who prayed, and so many who prayed with intensity and who prayed for so long. I thought for sure people would stop praying, and I'd ask Noreen when she had prison visits, are people still praying? Because I was sure there are so many crises in the world for you to pray for that people would move on to another thing. But so many prayed for so long and so with such intensity. And what's really unusual to me, catches my attention, is how many countries it went into. Millions of Chinese were praying. I thought, I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed of this. God, they have so many of their own people in prison. How can they be praying for me? Iranians were praying for me. People all over the world. Somebody just came up to me from Tunis who said the Congolese in his church were praying for me. People from so many nations. And we begin to see, actually, my assignment was not cut short. Prison was part of the assignment of preparing for harvest. Because what God was doing was raising up sons and daughters around the world in millions of them, to pray into one of the very dark places in the world, against one of the great, very dark principalities, spiritual powers. And if Satan had known this was going to happen, I don't think he would have had me arrested. He wanted to knock Noreen and me out, which shouldn't have been that difficult. But instead, what he got was this big confrontation. And I don't think he planned for that. I think God outmaneuvered him. He's the grandmaster chess player, isn't he? And so, since many of you are studying missions, I want to put this before you and say, this is the time for the Muslim world. As you consider missions, as you consider what countries to go to, this is the time for the Muslim world. I just present before you as evidence of it, the prayer movement. God could have focused it on any number of countries. Instead, he chose to focus it on Turkey, because when Turkey is a key, when it breaks spiritually, when there's this massive move, it's going to affect the countries in that region. So this is the time to go into that part of the world. I want to I have a burden, an urgency in my heart. I don't know if there's a, I need to make sure I'm on time. What time do I need to finish? Okay. I have an urgency in my heart for your generation. And I've never had this before because I've been focused on the Muslim world for so many years and overseas because I have a strong missionary calling from the time I was a child. And so I was always focused overseas, and my heart is still wanting to go over. We want to return to the Middle East. But since coming back to the States, I've had an urgency in my heart for your generation because I think that there is persecution coming and that your generation is not ready for it. I'm not saying my generation is ready for it either, but we have a long head start. And you're also the generation of my children. My children are 18, 21, just about 24. And I see a different environment that they're growing up, that they're going into now, and that you are going out into than when I graduated from college. It's much more hostile. The culture, it used to be more of a fringe elite that was openly hostile to Christianity. And now it has spread into the mainstream. And there's such hostility. And I think many are not ready for what is coming. One of the greatest challenges is speaking truth in this generation. And everyone seems to be broadcasting their own truth, my truth, your truth. But speaking truth is saying about things what God says about them. And you will be challenged, especially in the areas of holiness and morality and of the exclusivity of Jesus, of his identity, what he demands. And there's a spiritual battle that's going on behind so many of the political issues and cultural issues in our day. Who's going to define truth? Who's going to define morality? Who defines identity? This is one of the big battlegrounds now. And God claims that right for himself. And Jesus said that people will call what is evil good and what is good evil. And we're already seeing this, and it's going to get much worse. And for those who stand for Jesus, for those who desire to live a godly life, it's going to mean a loss of prestige sometimes, maybe losing a job. It could be worse than that even. And there's no way around it. The truth is offensive. And many take offense at Jesus, and there's clearly an attempt to silence his voice. And I see the political and the media classes, increasingly the business classes as well, most of academia. They want us to not only show tolerance, but to actually celebrate things that are clearly against the teaching of Scripture. And people are going to not only say that you're wrong and disagree with you, but they're going to say that you're evil. I tasted a bit of this in Turkey. The coverage, the media coverage was vile. They said I was a terrorist, that I hated Turks. They said I had said I wanted to cut the heads off of Turks. Very inflammatory things. They said I wanted to establish a Christian state by force. In the media, they call me the dark priest, the terrorist priest, the spy priest. My favorite was Rambo priest. Yeah, they did. They said if they'd accused me of starting churches, of evangelizing Turks, I would have been glad for that. I would have worn it with pride, but they didn't. That would have been too easy. And instead, they painted me as dangerous, as evil, as a traitor, someone who should be despised and hated. And this was a government-led propaganda campaign. And by painting me that way, of course, they were painting all believers in the country in the same way. So that in the future, they're preparing people. In the future, when there is persecution, most Turks are going to say, well, they deserve that. So the question is, are you ready to be called evil? Are you ready to be despised and looked down on? Because if you stand for Jesus, it's probably going to happen. Are you prepared to stand without apology for Jesus? Are you prepared to stand when the Twitter mob attacks you? Are you willing to be denied jobs? And we need to teach that persecution is coming. I think of some of you, a number of you are going into ministry. I heard that about a third of you plan to go into like a full-time ministry, whatever you want to call it, whatever the right terms are for that. And another two-thirds will go into the marketplace. And we need to prepare ourselves to stand. The time to prepare is now, not when you're in the middle of difficulties and having to respond to them. Jesus taught that if we're not ready, if we're not prepared, then it's very dangerous. And there are especially, there are four areas that people will fall in, especially if they're not prepared ahead of time. And the most important thing, I think, is having the right mentality to know that we will face persecution, we will face opposition, and begin to plan for it. Prepare your heart so that when it comes, it doesn't knock you out. It doesn't blindside you. Many people will be deceived. These are things that Jesus said. If you're not prepared, you're more likely to be deceived. And people will look for teaching that justifies compromise, that allows them to escape hardship. And we know this was a problem in the early church. Jesus severely warns the churches in Revelation because they've tolerated teaching that justifies compromise. Do I offer incense to the emperor and in this way engage in idol worship? Well, I don't really believe that he's a god, so I'll do it. And because if you don't, you'll be considered a traitor and disloyal. You may even be executed. Or to have a job in those times, you had to be part of a guild. And they had idolatrous feasts with a lot of immorality. If you don't participate, then maybe you won't be able to hold a job and you won't be able to support your family. And so teachers arose in the churches who said, oh, it's okay. It's all right. And one of the main areas, if you notice, back then, 2,000 years ago, was dealing with sexual immorality. The heart of man is the same. We're still dealing with the same challenges. And the early church faced that pressure to compromise, and many teachers justify taking the easy way out. And that's a problem in our churches now. For those of you going into leadership, going into churches and into Christian ministries, so many leaders now are afraid to have controversy in their ministries, in their churches, and outside of it. So they stay away from teaching the truth. And if we're not willing to stand for truth as leaders, how can we expect the people we lead to stand for Jesus without apology? The second thing, well, the first is many will be deceived. The second, and many leaders are tempted to compromise so that they, in their teaching, so that they don't offend the people that they lead. The other is that many will react from fear. And some of you are going to be in situations where you become afraid. Maybe it's not physical violence that you'll face. Maybe you will. Or maybe it will be loss of a job or loss of financial security, and any number of things. I know what fear is. I'm an expert on fear. I had a lot of fear. And I faced danger before, but I was overwhelmed in prison with the threat that I would never be with my wife or children again, that I would die in a Turkish prison in terrible isolation. I remember one day, just as an example, my cellmate said, oh, Andrew, you're on TV right now. And there was something scrolling underneath on the channel, and it was saying, Priest Brunson is to go on trial. The state wants life imprisonment, a life sentence. I thought, oh, no. So they're doing it after all. They're actually going to put me on trial for life imprisonment. And I was just numb. I couldn't talk to my wife. I couldn't talk to anybody who would encourage me. I was just in a cell with another prisoner. And I was numb and fearful. And that night, Noreen and I had a reading program, so we would be reading the same things together. It was a way, even though we were separated, that we could feel closer to each other. And that night, Psalm 118 was a psalm I was supposed to read. And I'm reading through Psalm 118, and I come to a verse that says, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? And I thought, I can think of a lot of things. Yeah. Fear is real. And we prepare ourselves ahead of time so that when we are afraid, we react not from that fear, but from the right perspective. You have to get an anchor now. Know what you're going to hang on to now. Know what your decisions are supposed to be now. Because otherwise, the first instinct is to run away. The reason the military is more effective than a mob is because of their discipline. Because the soldiers have been trained to stand, even when they're afraid, to not run when you're persecuted. And when you're flooded with fear, you have to have made that decision ahead of time. You have to have trained yourself, made the decision that you will stand for Jesus, that he is worthy of whatever you are going to face. And that because of that, you will not move. Because you need something to cling to when the instinct is to run away. I would have run out of prison if the doors had opened, even if God said, Andrew, I want you to be in prison. The first year, I would have run. I would have been just like Jonah. It took almost a year for me of training and submission. It took almost a year for me where I got to get to the point where I could say, Lord, if the prison doors open now, I would really try to stay. If I believe that, because if this is the assignment you have for me, I want to complete it. But it took me a very long time before I was able to reach that. And I thank God that I didn't have the choice in prison, because I would have run probably. As I said, it took me about a year to get to the point where I was consistently willing to serve God through imprisonment. And in the end, I did become strong enough to stand before hostile judges and media and to declare the supremacy of Jesus. But I went through a lot of battles before I was able to do that. Jesus also says that people aren't ready. Many will fall into drunkenness and immorality. That is, they will find things to self-medicate to get away from the stress, escape the stress and the fear. And also many will be offended. And this is a big one. I was very offended at God for a long time in prison. I didn't know. I had so many questions. I can't go into the reasons for them because of time, but I had many questions, many doubts. And my heart started to become cold towards the Lord because of offense. There were things I couldn't understand. And Jesus says that this is what will happen if we're not ready when the pressure comes. Many believers will be offended at what God allows. Many will be offended because in the midst of difficulties, they will think that God has abandoned them. And they'll be so disappointed that their heart will become cold and they turn away. So this is a time to prepare so that you're not blindsided, so that you can stand faithfully. I want to mention a couple of the things that helped me get through. The first is fear of God, the right perspective. And I prayed for this so much in prison. I was confident that if I had the right perspective of God, his majesty, his greatness, that of who he is, then I wouldn't question him. And I'd be much more willing to bear whatever was necessary. And I thought about Paul. You know, Paul says, he talks about his suffering and about these momentary light afflictions that they cannot compare to the glory that is to come. You know that verse, right? And people would write that verse to me, and it's true. It is true. But it's very hard for us to think that way and to actually shape our emotions and our thinking according to that truth, to respond to it as we should. Because we haven't experienced it, and I thought, well, Paul had such an advantage. You know, he had an encounter with the resurrected Jesus and all of his glory, so powerful. It knocks him off his horse. It's amazing. Then he sees Jesus several times in visions. And then it says that Paul went, he had a visitation to heaven. He was exposed. He saw things from the perspective of heaven. And so, of course, he can say, look, these are momentary light afflictions. Just hold on, because what's coming is so amazing. And the reward for your suffering and blah, 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 blah. Because he saw it. And I said, oh, God, if you would just let me visit heaven too, then I could have the same perspective. Or Jesus appeared to me in this cell. I so desired it, and I still want to see him. I'm waiting for that. Before I die, I'd like to see him too. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And unless you have one of those encounters with God, then basically you have to cultivate fear of God. It doesn't happen naturally. It's harder for us. But that's the point. We have to work at it. We have to seek it. God himself says, I will put the fear of me in their hearts so that they do not depart from me. If we have his fear in our hearts, if we have the right perspective of God, then we're much more likely to press on in persecution. And the opposite is true. If we don't have that, then we're much more likely to slip away when difficulty comes. So ask for this fear of God. Ask for God to give you his perspective on suffering, on eternity. And don't wait for persecution to start before you do this. Start doing it now. I started going after this every day in prison. Lord, put your fear in my heart. Put your fear in my heart. Start doing it now. When difficulties come, it's very likely that you will be afraid. But what will you fear more? The consequences of standing for God or the consequences of not standing for God? Will you care about God's opinion or that of the social media mob? And the answer will depend a great deal on how much fear of God is in your heart. The second thing I want to emphasize, and this is the most important thing, Jesus said it's the most important thing, it's the main commandment. What's the most important commandment? You all know it. To love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. In 2007, I started to run after God in a new way. I'd been a missionary for 14 years at the time. I'd started some churches already, had a PhD. And I mention this because we were in ministry. We'd already seen some things happen. But I became hungry for more of God. And I assure you, no matter where you are, how long you've walked with God, how faithful you've been, there's always more of God. There's always more and more that you can have of him, closer that you can get to him, deeper that you can go. So we began to spend a lot of time seeking God's face. I began to hunger to experience God's glory. And we set pursuing intimacy with God as our main goal, our main value in everything that we did. Hearing his voice, seeking his presence, learning to soak in his presence, learning to live as sons and daughters of the Father. And we were involved in ministries, church planting, worked with refugees, started a house of prayer, training programs. But in all of those, the main goal in every one of them was intimacy, was loving God. And everything in our lives, living godly lives, living for the kingdom, relationships with other people, how we do our jobs, everything flows out of this intimacy. And if the relationship with God is right, it doesn't mean that things will be easy, but everything will eventually come into the right alignment and perspective in our lives. So I had run after God's presence for years. I had tasted his presence. I had encounters with him and was focused on intimacy with him. But when I went into prison, my love for God was really tested. The question was, would I survive prison, not only physically, but more importantly, would my heart survive? And at one point, I had broken very badly. I broke a number of times in prison, but I had broken very badly, and I was suicidal. And I read something that sobered me up. It mentioned how many Christians go into a valley of testing, and the valley of testing is full of dry bones and full of skeletons. They're believers who have failed in the valley of testing. And their relationship with God has just broken down. It doesn't mean they're not going to heaven. They can go to heaven, but the point here is there are plans that God had for them. There's an inheritance God intended for them to win. And they end up with no fruit in their lives. And somehow this went into my heart. I think God just put it into my heart. I started to say, oh God, I'm so close to that. I'm broken. I'm suicidal. My heart has become so cold. I don't want to end up being one of those skeletons, a man who loses his inheritance of what you wanted to do through me, the things you wanted me to accomplish for your kingdom. I don't want to fail in the valley of testing. And I made a decision. There was so little I could do to fight for my freedom, but it was completely up to me to fight for my relationship with God. I thought, if I lose my relationship with God, I've lost everything. And I started to fight. I had to fight. I had to take the initiative, because love and devotion and intimacy and endurance, they don't happen automatically. And I told God, whatever you do or don't do, whether you speak to me or not, whether you give me your presence or not, whether you rescue me or not, I am going to press into you. Whatever you do or don't do, I'm going to follow you. This is my decision with my will to run after you. And this marked a turning point from then on. That decision I'd made years before, I'd been pursuing God for years, but now I was doing it in very different circumstances, in very hard circumstances. I was cut off from all other Christians. I prayed alone. I worshiped alone. I was facing years in prison. But as much as possible, I decided to focus myself on God throughout the day. And I'm underlining this because Jesus said that the most important thing we can do is run after him and love him. The most foundational thing is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You know the verse. And you also know as Bible, you know, you're in a Christian school. Many of you study Bible. You know that it's possible to be in a school like this and not be passionate for God. So this is the most important thing, to love him with everything we are. And this love is what will make you willing to stand for Jesus, to pay a price, to persevere. And it's so obvious, it seems so simple, yet somehow many of us still miss it. There's nothing more important than this, than loving God, and it includes feelings, but it's more than this. It includes devotion and obedience and pursuit. And it doesn't happen automatically. Many start out with passion, but very few pursue God long term. Many people do not finish well. You become more aware of this as you get older. Some of my close friends are no longer walking with the Lord. Some are walking with him, but they don't have passion for God. I had to pursue, and I keep sliding. This is our natural tendency. We naturally decrease in love. We don't naturally increase in love for God. We have to pursue it. It has to be nurtured. Ask for it every day. And if you're not hungry, the best way to become hungry is just to ask for it. Say, God, I'm not hungry, but I want to hunger for you. I'm not thirsty for your presence, but I want to. Give it to me. Show me your love. Reveal your love to me. I want to love you. And as you do this, as you approach him again and again and again like this, your heart will soften, tenderize, and a fire will start there. So I had to pursue. I had to pursue. And I have to renew my pursuit now also. Years ago, a friend of mine, John, told me about talking with Richard Wurmbrand, who was a Romanian pastor who was imprisoned for 14 years, endured terrible torture under the communist regime. And Richard Wurmbrand told John, he said, you know, sometimes I just miss my cell in that prison. When I heard that, I thought, this guy's just crazy. He said, I miss the intimacy I had with God there. And I don't miss being in prison. I don't want to go back to prison. I'm glad I'm out. But there is something that I miss from that experience, that terrible ordeal. The conditions of my imprisonment, the isolation, the threats, the fears, they really tested me. They pushed me to my limits and beyond. But they also drove me to cling to God as I never had before. They brought a rare clarity about what matters, what's really important. And my everyday in prison became consumed with seeking God and drawing close to him as a matter of spiritual survival. And now I'm free and I'm so glad to be free, but I miss that desperation that I had. It doesn't happen naturally. We have to go after it. And I want to recapture that desperate seeking that I had then. So I'm urging you to prepare yourself. To prepare yourself for the challenges that will come your way, for this hostile world that you're going into. And so let me make it very simple. A lover will endure more than a servant. A lover is willing to suffer for his beloved. And God has many servants, but he has many less lovers. Are you a servant or are you a lover of God? Intimacy is what fuels longevity. It is what keeps you going in difficulties. And it was fear of God, the fear of God that grew in prison and a love for God that fueled my perseverance. I want to end telling you something that happened in prison. Towards the end of my first year in prison, I was called suddenly into a court session, and I was charged with attempting to overthrow the Turkish government and with military espionage. And the automatic sentence for this is 3 life sentences in solitary confinement with no parole. And this just really hit me. I'd already been pressing in for 2 or 3 months after this Valley of the Bones understanding or thing that hit me. And I'd been running after God, trying to press into Him, focus myself on Him. And then this just hit me and it knocked me down. I thought, 3 life sentences in solitary confinement. I won't see my children again. I won't be with my wife again. I'm going to just waste away and die in this prison. And it knocked me down. But within a couple of weeks, as I was crying out to God, just all my feelings and thoughts, what came out of my mouth, a song. I wrote a song. It just came from my, it was a heart song. You are worthy of my all. You're worthy of whatever I'm going through. And I wrote a verse that says, I want to be found worthy to stand before you on that day with no regrets from cowardice or things left undone. To hear you say, well done, my faithful friend, now enter your reward. Jesus, my joy, you are the prize I'm running for. And I prayed, I sang that every day for the rest of my imprisonment for another year. This was what I want to underline. This became my main prayer. I want to live in such a way that I have no regrets when I stand before Jesus. Regrets in heaven, you think, no regrets in heaven. I don't think we're going to live with the weight of regret. But I thought someday I'm going to stand before Jesus. Every one of us will, and there will be people who stand before Him. And Jesus will say, I love you, and you can go into heaven. But you wasted your life. You wasted your life. And I started to live with this reality, with this perspective. And you see, what had happened before is at a very low point, I had said, Lord, I renounce my inheritance. I spent 23 years in Turkey at that time, up to that time, just investing, working in that land. And I said, Lord, I give it up. And anything that you've planned to do with me in the future, I give it up. I'm willing to be the least person in heaven. Just release me and let me go home to my family because I can't handle it anymore. I can't handle this. Let me go. Whatever your plans are, I don't want them. And now, several months later, I was repenting and saying, no. Whatever your plans are for me, if it means staying in prison, if your assignment for me is prison, I don't want to be here. But even more than that, I want to stand before you without regret. And if this is my assignment, then I want to embrace what you have planned for me. I don't want any of your plans to fall to the ground. Every one of them, make them happen. Give me the endurance, the perseverance, to press on and be faithful. And so I began to fight every day to bring myself to that point of submission where I embraced the assignment that He gave me, even if it meant prison. I had gained a measure of the fear of God by going after it every day. And my love for Jesus had been tested and it had grown. And this drove me. Why is this important? Because if I love Jesus, then I'll be willing to stand for Him even if it costs me. Because I love Jesus, I will obey even if it costs me. Because I love Him, I'll serve His purposes. Because I love Him, I won't be ashamed. Because I love Him, I will pursue Him. And that's why I urge you as the most important thing, the most urgent thing that you can be involved in, that you need to focus on is cultivate that passion, that devotion to Jesus now, because it is what will help you stand in the future. When I wake up in the morning, and I did this morning, I try to start off my day by saying this. The only thing that matters is what my King, what Jesus thinks of me, and what He says about me. The only thing that matters, Jesus, is what you will say about me, what you will think about me on the day I stand before you. Nothing else can compare There's nothing more important. And so to be faithful in my generation and to love him, to stand unashamed without apology for my king, that's what I'm living for. And someday you will also stand before King Jesus. And may you do so without regret. I want to pray for you. Oh, Lord God, I pray for my brothers and sisters, this generation, these people in this room. Oh, Jesus, I'm so glad that you win in the end. You were king and you win in the end. But I ask that you release callings today. I ask that you release callings to missions, to the Muslim world. I ask that you release an impartation of passion for you, of love for you. Just deposit flames into every heart. Make us yearn for you, yearn for your presence, to hunger for you, to run after you. Put your fear in our hearts that we stand and not run, that we live for your approval and care not what man thinks of us. I ask that you raise up warriors from this group. Raise up warriors and raise up devoted lovers of Jesus. May they stand unashamed of you, Jesus. May they be found worthy to stand before you on that day with no regrets. And I finish by praying for you what I prayed for myself and my family every day for the second year of my imprisonment. Father God, pour out on your sons and daughters the courage, the strength, the confidence, the perseverance, the endurance, and the steadfastness of Jesus, that we may run the race set before us and finish well, purified in the fires of faithful obedience, tested and found worthy of our beloved, of Jesus, the King of glory. I bless you in the name of my King, Jesus Christ. Amen.
We hope you found this message a blessing to your life. More Columbia International University Chapel messages are available at iTunes and at podcast.ciu.edu. Learn more about CIU's undergraduate, seminary, and graduate programs at our website, ciu.edu. Columbia International University educates people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for the opportunity to minister to you today.